The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, chapter 1, verses 19 to 51. the lectures for the remainder of the course of the semester have a similar format. I usually begin by talking a little bit about the structure of the passage, both its own internal structure and also how the passage relates to what precedes and follows. Then often I will have a section dealing with historical issues, historical problems sometimes that may arise, and then another section dealing a bit more directly with the theological thrust of the passage. Now, I don't always follow that pattern. Sometimes it's a little bit more obvious than other times, but it will be the pattern for today. And ideally, I like the actual lecture to end 10, 15, 20 minutes before the end of the two-hour period. We will have a break. The idea being that if you have done your work ahead of time, you have jotted some things, and either out of your own reflection in the text or whatever I may have been saying, that we can have some sort of meaningful discussion. But I'll be happy to entertain questions as we go along as well. So, first of all, the structure of the passage. Before I forget, please don't forget that Bob Gundry is going to be here tomorrow giving a general lecture at 10:10 and then a bit more specialized lecture at 2 o'clock. And I think you'll really enjoy his material, so I encourage you to be here. With regard to the structure of this passage, something that probably jumps at you as you're reading this, maybe it doesn't, it jumps at some people, is the sequence of days, the reference to days, on the one day, on the next day, and the following day, and so on. And this sequence apparently climaxes at chapter 2, verse 1. You remember that the beginning of chapter 2 John begins that pericope by saying, on the third day, kaitehe mera te trite, on the third day. But there has been a sequence of more than 3 days from the start of the pericope in chapter 1, verse 19. And these references, you know, can hardly be accidental or trivial. They must give us some kind of clue as to John's structuring of the passage. And I do not mean by that, and this is, I think, an important distinction to keep in mind, because whenever you talk about some kind of double meaning or some symbolic reference in John, the tendency is to think of it in terms of some kind of enigmatic narrative, some kind of secret that you have to discover, without which you cannot make sense of the gospel. And that's not at all what I have in mind here. I think that the kind of symbolism or the kinds of double meanings or whatever that John uses throughout the gospel, and we'll see plenty of examples of this, are intended primarily as literary associations. It's his way of getting you to think about a network or several networks of related ideas. And I am not thinking so much in terms of discovering some mysterious key that all of a sudden unlocks, you know, the real meaning of the gospel. That's not what what's going on here. Now, let me mention a couple of the possibilities. C.H. Dodd, now this is in his other book on historical tradition, suggests that the 3 days mentioned in chapter 1 seem to have a correspondence to the prologue, verses 6 through 8 of the prologue, where we're told first that John is not the light, then we're told that he testifies to the light, and further, he's supposed to lead men to believe in the one who is the light. Now that development, he was not the light, supposed to be a witness to the light, and then he leads others to see the true light. And Dodd points out there seems to be a correspondence between that threefold idea and what happens in these first three days. First, he denies that he is the Christ. He then gives a spontaneous witness to Christ, and then his disciples begin to move over to Jesus. That's one way of thinking about it. The other way of thinking about it, of course, is that by talking about these days, and then you have that reference to the third day in chapter 2, John begins to anticipate some of the more fundamental developments in the book, particularly in terms of Christ's resurrection. Although that, obviously, when you read it the first time, if you don't know the story, you have no idea what's going on. But again, you've got to read the Gospel of John at least twice to make good sense of it. A number of scholars, many scholars, have pointed out that the narrative is characterized by what some people call anachronies. Anachronies. Now, you need to understand that term as a literary description. It's not intended necessarily to have a negative nuance. You know, when you talk about something being anachronistic, usually you mean that something has gone awry, either by carelessness or whatever. That's not what this meant. What this term is supposed to imply. You may want to take a look at that book by Culpepper, Anatomy of the Fourth Gospel, pages 54 to 56. Culpepper 54 to 56, where he points out that not only here but elsewhere in the Gospel of John, if you are too picky, if you're real picky about chronological sequence and so on, things don't always fit exactly. But part of what Culpepper and others are suggesting is that this is not to be understood as some sort of failure on the part of the construction of the narrative, but maybe a deliberate technique whereby, in effect, in this particular passage, there are certain kinds of anticipatory comments that are intended to leave it up to the reader to figure out the proper order of events. And again, I think we want to avoid some picture of John, the author of this gospel, having a sophisticated literary theory that he's now implementing or something. It's that you have to approach his narrative from the point of view of somebody who is looking not so much for an exhaustive treatment of historical details, but somebody who, at least the approach of the author is to interest the reader, to let the reader supply information, if you will, because by doing that, the reader becomes more directly involved in the argument and in the narrative. So this is just a bit of an approach that may help you when dealing with certain kinds of apparent difficulties that arise. And this is obviously not peculiar or unique to the Gospel of John. It happens sometimes in the Old Testament narrative and elsewhere. Don't interpret apparent gaps in the narrative or things that don't fit. Don't interpret that as something is deficient historically, because the author probably was not intending to provide all of that data. But it is a conscious or semi-conscious element in the writing of the narrative that is meant to augment interest and also get the reader to be thinking along certain lines that then help to bring everything together as the narrative continues. In any case, and this is the bottom line of what I began to say, it is very likely that the sequence of days provides a clue to the structure of the narrative. In other words, that as you see those references to the days, it would be, I think, valid and helpful to use that as a way of, if you will, outlining the passage. And if you do that, you would probably come up with an outline like this one. And I don't remember for sure, but I think the outline that I'm about to give you comes primarily from Brown's commentary. There seems to be a basic twofold division in the narrative. The first section would be John's witness to Jesus, verses 19 to 34. Then the second major section of the narrative would be John's disciples, verses 35 to 51. And then you can begin to see this sequence of days providing like a skeleton for the narrative. Day one, where you have what I think you would have to describe as an implied witness. The Jews come to Jesus, to John, asking questions, and although John does not talk about Jesus directly, indirectly he does give a witness to who Jesus is by his negative response. I'll say more about that in just a second. So an implied witness in his answer to the Jews, and this would be verses 19 to 28. Day two is a more direct but spontaneous witness. And by spontaneous, I mean that in this case, you're not dealing with a response to a specific question, but something that that John takes initiative himself. Spontaneous witness in the presence of Christ, and this would be verses 29 to 34. Day three would come down here. Day three, there's a focus on the first group of disciples, but particularly on Peter, and that's verses 35 to 42. And finally, day four, where you have the second group of disciples with the focus on Nathanael, verses 43 to 51. So day three is the first group of disciples with the primary highlighting on Peter. Day four is Nathanael, the second group highlighting Nathanael. Just a little bit of additional detail in this first major section of the passage. The implied witness that I was talking about, implied in the sense that it is a response to the questions from the Jews, that you can also divide into two sections. One is the negative response, and then a positive response. The negative is in verses 19 to 23, but especially verse 20. The positive response is verses 24 to 28, and especially verse 26. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that you do have a two slightly different scenes there in day one. In the first one, the basic response is a negative one. He denied, verse 20, he denied. He confessed, and he did not deny, rather. And he confessed, I am not the Christ. I am not the Christ. In the second scene, where the specific answer is in verse 26, John answered and said to them, I baptize in water. In the midst of you stands one whom you do not see, the one who comes. It's 26 and 27, actually. I think that is deliberate here. Also, under day two, you could divide that into two further sections. An actual prediction in verses 29 to 31. And then a sign is given, verses 32 to 34. One last comment about the outline. It would be possible to somehow incorporate into the outline, or even let what I'm about to tell you become a more fundamental criterion in composing some sort of outline, but incorporating the titles given to Christ as the narrative is developed. Here, under the sign that John the Baptist gives, there's a reference to Jesus as the Son of God, the Son of God. Verse 34, and I have seen and I have given witness that this is a huios to theou. Then, under day three, you have the use of the term Christ, Christos, in verse 41. This is when Andrew looks for Simon and says to him, we have found ton Messian, which is translated Christos. And then finally, in the very last paragraph here, under day four, Nathanael refers to him, to Jesus also, Son of God, and we're going to, also as the King of Israel, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more later on. But in addition to that, Jesus calls himself Son of Man, and there's, I think, a particular significance in that. So the use of titles in reference to Jesus obviously forms part of the development of the story, and it's something that needs to be given special attention. Well, so much for the structure. Any questions about how this narrative seems to be put together? All right, if not, let's move on then to the second part of the lecture here, historical problems. I really don't want to spend a great deal of time during the course of the semester dealing with challenges to the historical worth of the Gospel of John, because, I mean, you could take, there are so many questions that have been raised about the historicity of the Gospel of John that you could literally spend the whole semester and more trying to respond to every one of them. And I don't think that's particularly edifying or whatever. And it tends to shift focus, you know, distract us from what I think is far more important than that, as you're trying to make sense of the gospel. But I think that at least some of these problems need to be addressed. And part of what I'm hoping that I can do by handling a few of them is to suggest, you know, what's the range of options available to us when we come across a problem? What are the possible responses to those problems? What are the what are legitimate solutions to them? I don't think that there's any one principle or method that is going to work every time. But I think you need to be aware of which are possible and to try to develop some kind of consistent way of dealing with these difficulties. Now, in this particular passage, there are at least four interesting details that raise questions concerning the historicity of the gospel. And I want to talk about those four. And I'm hoping that after I have gone through those four, the rest of the semester, I will probably say very little. There are a couple more that we need to discuss in some detail. But my intention is simply to refer you back to today's lecture and tell you, remember what I did there? Well, you do something similar here. Okay. The first one has to do with the reference to the priests and the Pharisees that come to John the Baptist to ask questions. There's something a little peculiar, about the way in which these interrogators are brought into the story. In verse 19, we're told that hoi judaioi, the Jews, sent to John priests and Levites from Jerusalem. So that's the setting in verse 19. The Jews, whoever that is, and remember, it's a lot of discussion about the use of this term, hoi judaioi, in the Gospel of John. But whoever is intended, whoever John intends to allude to by that phrase, these Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask John some questions. But then you go to verse 24, and now the people who are asking the questions are introduced in a somewhat different way. Apestalmenoi eisan ek ton pharisaion. Apestalmenoi eisan ek ton pharisaion. They were sent from the Pharisees, or out of the Pharisees. Now, the first obvious question, I suppose, is whether the people mentioned in verse 24 are being identified with the ones described back in verse 19. Now, if they are, if the reference in verse 24 is intended as a further reference to those people mentioned in verse 19, We do appear to have a major anachronism, not an anachrony as I was using the term earlier, but an anachronism in the bad sense of the term. A mistake. John is either unaware of or decides to blur, in an illegitimate way, the distinctions that were present at the time of Christ. In other words, some people at least would argue that here the author may have been unfamiliar with the religious situation in Palestine early in the first century, and instead presents a picture that accords with the situation in his time, after AD 70, when the Pharisaic position became more or less identified with Judaism as such. You understand what's going on here? We know perfectly well that prior to AD 70, the Pharisees were just one out of probably a large number of groups. Even if you take seriously Josephus's reference to there were 6,000 Pharisees, which is a pretty big number, that still represents a minority in Palestine. And although I think it is accurate to say that large portions of the people, more generally, were sympathetic to the Pharisaic position, it was definitely, in terms of some kind of an official position, if you will, you certainly could not identify the Pharisaic viewpoint with the Jewish position. After all, the Sadducees were the ones in authority with the, because of their control over the priestly families and so on. And it seems to be a case of somebody at the end of the first century, when now the Judaism and Pharisees, that's practically equivalent. And now you're talking about priests and Levites who are from the Pharisees. Well, the priests and Levites were not from the Pharisees, strictly speaking. So therefore, John appears to have made some kind of mistake. Now, there's a little text critical problem. I mean, as little as you can get. It's just a definite article. But a little problem that gets into the picture, because the majority text reading does have the article before the participle. In other words, instead of in verse 24, kai apestalmenoi eisan, the majority text and a few others say kai hoi apestalmenoi. And those who were sent were from the Pharisees. If you take that majority reading, then that would nail the identification of the two groups as being the same. Now there is no ambiguity left. Those who had been sent, meaning you have to be referring back to the people already mentioned, verse 19, were from the Pharisees. Now, the addition of the definite article is almost certainly a secondary reading. It's attested only by late witnesses, and I don't think we need to take it very seriously as having any claims to being an original, the original reading. But even if you dismiss that article, that variant, it provides something of a clue, because what it really tells you, what I think it ought to tell you, is that the later scribes themselves, who would have been unaware of the historical problem, in other words, if you have some Greek copyists in the Middle Ages, they didn't know these historical nuances about the Pharisees before or after AD 70. And not being aware of that, they had perhaps some difficulty understanding the anarthros participle without the article, except as referring to anything other than the previously mentioned group. And so consciously or unconsciously, they added the article as a way of clarifying what was really going on. If that analysis is correct, and I think, you know, most people would say, yeah, that makes sense as a way of explaining the transmission of the text. That makes me a little suspicious about any attempts to circumvent the problem by translating in a way that does not identify the two groups. Now, a couple of the possibilities are, and some Pharisees had been sent. And some Pharisees had been sent. Now you're talking, you know, it's a different situation now. It's not the priests and Levites back in verse 19. Now we're talking about a different group. Some Pharisees had been sent. Or, another possibility that has been suggested, some Pharisees who were in the deputation asked him, and so it goes. You see what I'm, maybe the logic isn't perfectly clear here, but what I'm getting at is this. There are a number of commentators, and by the way, that second translation that I just gave you comes from the New English Bible, but Don Carson thinks it's also a legitimate one. That's the one that he goes for. What you're doing here is saying, well, there is no article, therefore we do not have to identify the people in verse 24 with the ones in verse 19. And you come up with some translation that helps you to avoid the identification. Some Pharisees had been sent, or some Pharisees who were in the deputation, whatever. I'm not saying that's an impossible translation, but if that's what the author wanted to convey, it is pretty probable that he would have used a definite pronoun, tines, you know, tines, apestameno, eisen, etc. Carson and some of the other people who hold on to this view give no linguistic evidence for translating the clause this way. And indeed, the motivation for that translation is not some linguistic datum, but rather strictly one of preserving the historical accuracy of the reference. I am not convinced that's going to work. And I would prefer, Bernard, for example, in the ICC series translates, and they had been sent from the Pharisees. In which case you do have an identification. It's not as explicit as if you had the definite article there. But I think it is the most natural way of reading the text, that the people that have been mentioned in verse 19 are now described as people who were from the Pharisees. Now, if that is the case, does that mean that we have a historical error here? Well, I don't think so. And by the way, this particular historical problem, which in one sense is a somewhat trivial one, provides an excellent example of something that I think we need to develop some sensitivity to in dealing with the Gospel of John generally. Not to be too quick to solve problems because we're motivated, you know, we need to save John, you know, from a lack of historicity or what have you. There is another way, and the other way I think can be illustrated with what's going on here. As you look at John's use of the term Hoyudaioi, the Jews, Carson, for example, and I think it's useful to refer to him since he disagrees with me on the interpretation of this verse, but Carson himself acknowledges that John was, and here I'm quoting, John was influenced by his own context at the time of writing. Apparently, John is seeking to press the claims of Jesus Messiah on his own Hellenistic Jewish readers. And therefore, the failures of the Jewish leaders who were Jesus' contemporaries constitute an admirably clear warning. This comes from page 142 in Carson's commentary. So Carson acknowledges, I think he accepts the principle that I am really very interested in trying to get across here. Namely, that when you read the Gospel of John, you need to be thinking not only of the historical context of Jesus' ministry, but also the context of the time when John is writing. And again, the way that Carson puts it is that John is trying to press the claims of Christ on his Hellenistic Jewish audience, and a great way of doing that is to use the leaders in Jesus' time as an example, as a warning to them. Now, if we're willing to go that far, is it possible to take this approach just a bit further? And this is where Ray Diller would say, are you allowing the camel's nose into the tent? And maybe you are. But can you take it a little bit further? And conclude that the late first century context at the time of writing may have led to some terminological imprecision, the way that Brown puts it. It's on page 44 of his commentary. And I'm quoting here what Brown says. The Judaism that survived the destruction of the temple, so post-AD 70 Judaism, was of strongly Pharisaic persuasion. And for a gospel written with this situation in mind, the terms Pharisees and Jews would be the most meaningful titles for the Jewish authorities. Thus, we may have here, he says, a simplification. See what he's saying? That a concern for nuancing the terms and being very precise with regard to the way the terms were used in the first part of the first century would distinguish sharply between Pharisees and Jews. At the end of the first century, when Judaism and Phariseeism were more or less identified, it would be natural for language to become somewhat simplified, if you will. In which case, you would say, well, John is using terminology that is imprecise, but imprecise does not mean incorrect. And, you know, it's, I think, crucially important to make that distinction. See, if Brown's understanding here is valid, that would mean, we're not saying here that John, say, was unable to distinguish between the Jewish leadership in general and the Pharisees in particular at the time of Jesus' ministry. All it would mean is that in the late first century, and particularly in the diaspora, that distinction had become somewhat meaningless, except, you know, for people with some antiquarian interests, you know, historical scholars. If at the time that John is writing, and I recognize that this is an if, I cannot absolutely prove it, but if at the time of John's writing, in popular speech of that time, the term Pharisees was generally used in reference to Jewish leaders, as opposed to using the term with reference to a specific religious, political, social party. If the term was being used popularly with reference to Jews as a whole, then, to suggest that John has made a historical error is sheer pedantry. And you know that very, very frequently, not always, but very frequently, accusations or arguments against inerrancy have a very strong pedantic flavor to them, or at least these criticisms assume that the only way that the biblical writers could have been accurate is if they were being pedantic about making distinctions that were really unnecessary in any particular context. You know, it's not a relativizing of truth. It is not a relativizing of truth to recognize that a term such as accurate, whether something is accurate or not, has a diversity of meanings. And it really depends on the degree of precision required in a specific context. If somebody is measuring this classroom because they want to estimate, you know, what the square footage of the room is, a half inch margin of error would be considered quite accurate. That same margin of error would be a gigantic howler if you're ordering parts for electronic equipment. Similarly, precise terminology when you're recounting a past event depends largely on the purpose of your writing. Let me give you one example that perhaps helps us here. Nowadays, we know, people didn't know this a generation or two ago, but now we know that the term procurator, strictly speaking, applies to the Roman governors that ruled Palestine after AD 44. After AD 44. Pilate, strictly speaking, was not a procurator. He was a prefect. Now, that degree of precision could be important for some types of historical writing, but it would be quite irrelevant for others. And you see, if you end up confusing your readers because you insist in using only terms that are technically correct for each specific period, even though the office in question is exactly the same office, if you end up confusing your readers, you have hardly succeeded in communicating the truth, you see. And therefore, communicating truth and being accurate, being reliable, and so on, is something that has to be understood in the context of who you're talking to, for what purpose, you know, in what kind of a context. Seems to me that this principle, and it's a principle that I'm primarily concerned about here, I mean, whether you think it's the best solution to this specific problem or not, the principle is a pretty fundamental one when you're assessing the question of historicity in the Gospel of John. Now, it is true that many people very quickly jump from imprecision to unreliable. But I think that's hardly a responsible conclusion unless we think that John was in the business of writing encyclopedia articles. But how could John, I mean, some of you have heard me say this in a different context, but here's John at the end of the first century. How could he have ever imagined that someone centuries later was going to use what he was writing as a source for reconstructing the socio-political world of first century Palestine? If he had known, you know, there would be these nerds in the 20th century who had very limited information at their disposal, and his writing was going to be looked at and examined and dissected to see, you know, what was really happening in Palestine, I'm sure that he would have written things a little differently. But that's not what he was up to. And so you have to take that into consideration when you're dealing with what appear at first sight to be some inaccuracies. And they really aren't. at least not in the usual sense in which we, I mean, in normal conversation, in terms of social responsibility with one another when we tell stories or when we're giving an account, we use terminology that is most appropriate to the particular context or purpose, and we consider that reliable reporting. Well, you see, the point would be that if the term Pharisees is the way to refer to Jewish leaders, it just highlights the importance of what he's getting at. You know, the same kinds of people that we're having to deal with today, they're the ones that we're sending a delegation or whatever to John the Baptist. Sometimes, and this is part of the difficulty of understanding always what John means when he says, Hoiudaioi. But when he says Hoiudaioi in verse 19, it may indeed, sometimes it's a very, very general term. Other times it is obviously a more specific reference to the leadership. Verse 24 dissolves the ambiguity. We're talking here about these leaders that, you know, we understand a particular way. These people opposed to Jesus, really. The second historical problem, more or less historical, is the question, was John the Baptist Elijah, or wasn't he? Was John the Baptist Elijah, or wasn't he? And you know, the question even arises because in verse 21, the people who came to interrogate him specifically say, they asked him, who are you? Are you Elijah? And he said, I am not. And then the next question, are you the prophet? And he answered, I'm not. No. So he appears to contradict the synoptic tradition, the synoptic accounts, because you will remember that in Matthew 11, verse 14, this is, remember, right after you know, John the Baptist is in prison, sends the disciples, his disciples, to ask Jesus, are you the one, and so on. Remember what happens there. But then after they leave, Jesus says, Matthew 11:14, if you are willing to accept it, he is Elijah who was to come. He is the Elijah who was to come. That's pretty explicit. And the same viewpoint appears to be reflected in Mark chapter 9, verse 13. Mark chapter 9, verse 13. And it's parallel in Matthew 17, verse 12. Matthew 17, verse 12. Where Jesus says, Elijah has already come. Now there you do not have an explicit identification with John the Baptist, but that's obviously what's in view. Now, Carson's approach, and I think he's right, I think maybe he dismisses the problem a little bit too quickly. I think maybe it's a more serious problem than he makes it out to be. But at the end of the day, I think he's probably right when he suggests that what's really going on is that John the Baptist did not detect as much significance in his own ministry as Jesus did. Now, that's kind of a psychological resolution of the problem. It doesn't mean that it's wrong. But John the Baptist, you know, didn't quite view his own ministry in the way in which Jesus would later describe it. On the other hand, you know, if the account in Luke 1 is correct, and I assume it's correct, and it is difficult to believe that Zechariah wouldn't have told his child what the angel told him about the prophecy from Malachi and all that. Presumably, John the Baptist had some consciousness. I mean, we're doing psychology here, so might as well. Had some consciousness of his being an Elijah. And so, although I don't think Carson is altogether wrong, situation is a little bit more complex. And There's some additional considerations that I think are of some value here. The very way in which the question is posed to John may help us here. See, it is preceded by the question whether he was the Messiah. And it is followed by the question whether he was the prophet. In that kind of a context, it would be very natural to see the Elijah identification as having some strong messianic implications. And John knew full well that he was not the Messiah. And in fact, you could say it's hardly imaginable that John could have answered in an affirmative way. I mean, even if he did see himself as a fulfillment of Malachi, which I would say that he did, but even granted that, to have answered that question, yes, I am Elijah, when the whole tenor of the question was, are you the Messiah? That's really what's, maybe you don't call yourself Messiah, but you call yourself by something else, but it's the same idea. For him to have answered in an affirmative way would have misled the audience. Perhaps we can also bring into the discussion the possible distinction between person and function. You know, well, maybe he's not the person of Elijah, but he functions as Elijah, that kind of thing. Raymond Brown in his commentary thinks that's not going to work because it was precisely the function that is an issue in this verse. But it seems to me possible that both John and Jesus might have distinguished between, on the one hand, the specific preparatory function of Elijah, which had been described by Malachi, and which had been fulfilled in John, and that function of preparing the way certainly was not fulfilled by Jesus. That was fulfilled by John the Baptist. So distinguish between that function of preparing the way, and on the other hand, the more personal messianic identification that could have been true only of Jesus. And the final consideration that I throw out with less enthusiasm, but there may be something to it, if it is true that the author of the gospel, one of the problems he has to deal with is some group that unduly exalted John the Baptist, to the extent that that suggestion is valid, to that extent, it was also important to record this denial on the part of John the Baptist. And so you have a variety of considerations being brought together here in understanding that verse. Any questions about that problem? Yeah.
Were the Jews asking the same question three times? Who are you? Are you Elijah? Are you the prophet?
I am not absolutely sure how much of a distinction they were making among those three terms. But, and part of the problem, you know that there is some debate as to what was the nature of the messianic expectations in Judaism, and not everybody had the same ideas. But certainly to say, the prophet, what could that be except the prophet, you know, that was promised like Moses and so on, whether it is viewed as a distinct figure or not, it would still have a strongly messianic function to it. So I'm just saying, all right, there are three things. Messiah is the first one, the prophet is the last one, the middle one is Elijah. In that context of questions, it would be very difficult to separate some kind of messianic identification. Yeah? Yeah. Of course, there's enough ambiguity in the Qumran documents themselves as to what precisely was going on there. But I would have to double check to see if that particular distinction is going to work here. I don't know. Maybe. And then you have to ask the further question, would the Qumranic viewpoint, would that have been represented here? Maybe, but I don't know. Good point. Yep. Right. Right. Yeah, and you see, while I do agree that you have at least three, maybe four how shall I put this? There's like a fourfold progression in you know, putting John the Baptist in his place over against some extreme claims that may have been made about him. He was not the light, and he was just a witness of light in the prologue. Then this passage here. Then the fact that his disciples move away from him. And then his own statement, Jesus must increase, but I must decrease. The important thing to notice is that in spite of that, as you point out, there's no equivocation about the reality of the character of his mission in terms of the Isaiah prophecy. And I mean, it would be just as wrong to ignore that or downplay it as it would be to not pay attention to the other side of it.